This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Why, hello there, friends. It is your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, and I am back with season 2 of A Good Cry. What? Season 2? They said it couldn't be done. No other podcast in history has ever had a second season until right now. New world record. Bow, 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 bow. Season 2 is going to be as good and better than season 1 because in addition to all the amazing guests and interviews, if I do say so myself, we're also broadening our scope a little bit. So we'll be talking about different kinds of grief with different kinds of people as well. So, of course, we've got comedians and we've got actors and we've got my buddies. We've also got a mental health professional. We've got authors. We've got a drag queen, for example, on this episode. You may know Dela from RuPaul's Drag Race. You may know Dela from interviews, from a trillion different live shows, or if you're lucky, from your dreams. But Dela and I talk about so many things that stuck with me after the episode, including griefing it up, therapists and switching therapists, and how difficult that can be, and of course, drag, and how all-encompassing that art form can be. After this conversation, I found myself not only more at peace with the world than I was when I began it, but also scrambling to find any time I could see Dela live. This is A Good Cry with the wonderful Ben de la Creme. Hope you like it. Okay, bye. I'm Michael, you're Dela, we're doing it. This is the podcast. Dela, so the way that we start the podcast is by asking the question, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
Whoa.
yeah, just a real light question
and
to kick
you know,
it
and
off.
I knew the question was coming, and yet somehow it's like something you... my relationship to grief feels sort of expansive. I lost my mom when I was fairly young. I was on the dividing line of 12 to 13. She died like right after my 13th birthday. And it informed a lot. You know, that was a big loss for me at a young age where I was really close to my mom and I was not super close to my dad. And I was a very weird, very queer kid. And my mom was sort of my, you know, the most stereotypical version of that relationship with a queer kid and his overly attached mother. And so, yeah, that really sort of plunged me into a super depressed, difficult adolescence that was very deeply unhappy. And that was kind of the trigger for that. And then throughout my adolescence, it sort of, you know, I mean, a lot of people go through those waves where it just feels like kind of everybody's dying. But it's weird because I don't actually talk about this that often because it feels small in comparison to my mom's death. But my first kiss, my first crush, and my first boyfriend all killed themselves. And
those are all different people?
All different people, yeah. And
oh my.
And so that all happened like throughout my teen years. And I like lost my grandparents who I was kind of close with, but not super. But it just was that thing where it felt like, oh, this bottle's been uncorked and now it's just going to be death, death, death forever, you know? And then, you know, at some point that slowed down and adulthood got better. But I would say that my relationship to grief is sort of ongoing and meandering and ebbs and flows. And it plays into the artwork I make a lot. And I go through periods where I feel like a very happy-go-lucky person who went through these character-building phases in my life. And I go through other phases where I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I'm just like one of those deeply scarred, sad people. And, you know, it comes and goes.
Yes, I know that exact of like, oh, I'm actually doing okay. And then other days where you're like, oh, no, I'm ruined.
Yes. Yeah, forever. It's and I would say even longer periods, you know, like I go through sort of, you know, there'll be like months at a time. I mean, I could even like probably talk about like years of my life where I just felt great, you know, where I just felt like things were going well. But it, and then it sort of dips back to like, oh God, my attachments are so flawed. My like way of interacting feels very sort of marred by this formative experience. And yeah, it's strange to have it come and go like that, because I do think there's a lot of conversation around sort of, I mean, I think a lot of us know better, but I think there's a lot of this idea that things get progressively, and even if it never quite goes away, it gets progressively easier. But I've not found that. I found that it's very cyclical. It's like a reverse circling of the drain. It's like this thing where it does... Both things are true. It does get easier. Those periods of like sadness and mourning get easier. And I'm not sure whether that's just because you get more used to them and you get the knowledge that they go away, you know, but I do find that it is not a linear thing where things just get progressively easier. The end.
Yes, I can absolutely identify with that. Okay, there's so much that you brought up in that first question. No, it's great. Can you talk a little bit more about your relationship with your mom?
Yeah. You know, I was just from a very young age, a very different child than the people around me. My mom was an art teacher. She was an artist, and she was, you know, I look back actually at that and I'm like, God, she was so motivated, because she just spent all day in her studio, like sculpting and painting and drawing. And I'm like, I don't know any artists who work that hard, but but she just was, you know, she was always at it and really derived so much joy from it. Like she loved being a teacher. And while she, you know, she shopped around some stuff that was like sort of, she was for a while pursuing illustrating children's books and some stuff like that. But for the most part, she just did it out of the love of it. And so I was just with her all the time, kind of doing that stuff alongside her. And I was a kid who was immersed in that artistic sensibility from a very young age. And it was a bond we really shared. And nobody else in my family was really like that. My dad has sort of a theater background, but his relationship to it was very different by the time I was born. So that was really, you know, I identified hard with being an artistic kid and that being where I found my joy. And that was very linked to my mom. So we just had a very, very strong bond. And, you know, as the older I got, the weirder other kids thought I was, the weirder other parents thought I was. And my mom really shielded me from that, made me feel better about it, and was just a resting place, right? Like when you're out there in the world and things feel really unsettled and terrible, right? It's wonderful when you have a place that you can go and take a break from feeling that way. And my mother was that place.
Were there other places, like other refuges for you at that age? Or was it really like, it's just my mom?
That was it. And so when she was gone, you know, and my relationship to my dad's a good guy, but we were not close when I was young. And it was I had that strong sensibility that I look back at and I'm like, God, what a bratty, awful kid. But I had that like strong thing where I was like, I did not want to share my mom with my dad. And my dad and I didn't necessarily like get each other. I didn't feel like my dad understood me as a young person. It wasn't that he didn't care for me and love me. It was just that I don't think he totally like got what I was about or knew how to connect with me. And part of that was me being super queer. You know, I was like very effeminate from a young age. And my dad was really, you know, he was like a college football guy and like all this stuff. So when my mom died, it was like we were thrown into this thing with each other, just me and my dad. And it was contentious. We fought constantly. We were not a source of support for each other. It was like we were really, neither of us knew how to handle it. And he was, I mean, also, again, through a child's lens, I'm sure this is very idealized, but the way I always saw my parents' relationship was very just sort of storybook. Like they were always very affectionate and loving with each other. I always remember that growing up was that it was their relationship was very romantic. And So I think that loss for my dad was such a huge hit. I mean, I think he's still reeling from it in some ways, you know. And so he was in no position to, like, care for a child, especially a child who was, like, struggling and mourning. So it was a bummer. We were rattling around in this old farmhouse we lived in the middle of the woods in Connecticut. And, like, we were just, like, on either ends of the house crying. It was deeply sad. Should I tell a joke?
No, I know that feeling of laughing at that, because I think objectively it's an incredibly sad sentence. But there is an element, I think, when you're like when you're reconstructing the worst parts of your grief, to think about it as if you're seeing it in a movie and almost be like, this is unbelievable. It is, in a way, hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, and we get, right, like, we have so many dark comedies where the humor really just comes from the discomfort of, like, exploring how awful something could be. And when you reflect on something in your life that just is a page out of one of those screenplays, it's like, what do you do with that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I also grew up in the woods-ish of Connecticut. Are you, like, in, like, a WASPy town? Like, what's the vibe of where you grew up?
What part of Connecticut?
I grew up in a town called Woodbridge, which is outside of New Haven. Do you know where that is?
I know Woodbridge, yeah. I grew up in Litchfield, but, like, right on the Litchfield-Torrington border.
Okay.
I actually recently had to go home for a funeral, and I was looking at this is Litchfield and Torrington in a nutshell. So Litchfield is, like, the place where all the, like, very rich New Yorkers have their second home. That's, like, a 5-story house, you know, and they're all painted white with black shutters, and it's very, like, regimented in this way. That's literally, it's like an ordinance that you have to paint your house white with black shutters, not even joking. And then Torrington is, like, a very different socioeconomic situation.
It's like a blue-collar town, kind of, right?
Yeah, and I grew up right on that border, like, sort of in the, you know, our closest neighbors were miles away, and it was a weird space. And it was a house that had been in my family for generations. And so we lived in the house my grandparents lived in, that their parents lived in, that their parents lived. And so in some way, I grew up in this house that was, like, haunted. I mean, there was so much mourning and grief already in that space. My dad had this weird attachment to it. I always hated that house. Anyway, I'm really getting off track.
I'm dragging you off track.
Oh, so I went. I do not need anybody else to get off track. I will meander my way through this interview, and you just shepherd me. But recently was going home for my stepsister's funeral, and I was looking at places to stay, and all I could find in Torrington was, like, a motel where there were, like, meth dealers, and the, like, floor was, like, covered in mold, and it was cost, like, $1. And then the other option of where to stay close by was the Litchfield Inn, which was, like, you know, $700 a night. And it's crazy. And those places are one town apart. And that's the summation of those two towns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Was it, in terms of being queer growing up in that area, what was that like? Were there other queer kids in your school?
Oh, Lord, no. No, no, no. I came out around 13. God, I don't know. It was, you know, I'm also one of those, like, when the hell did I come out things? Because it was, like, you know, everybody was calling me a fag from the time I was 7. So it was, like, at some point you just stop resisting is more like the coming out story, right? So, it's at some point you just don't argue anymore and you're like, okay. I was out very young, and there were no other out people in my school system. So, like, I guess I was in junior high, and in the junior high and the high school, which were attached, there was not a single other out queer kid. And I didn't know any. I didn't know any out gay people. And it was weird. And it was I'm 41 now. So this was also at a time when it was, like, there was not a lot of real connection through the internet. There weren't those communities. There wasn't that, like, broader awareness that things were out there. I had, like, an awareness that Queer as Folk was a show that existed on a channel I didn't get.
Right.
You know, it's like that sort of as much as I knew. And it was weird. And my experience too, right? I mean, I guess a lot of us find this frequently, but my experience as a kid there was being very much an outcast, and at some point just giving up and being just, like, as weird as I wanted to be, because what did I have to lose, right? So I always had, like, I mean, it was a very L.L. Bean style environment, and I, you know, ran through the full, like, pride flag of hair colors throughout my school experience and just sort of did not even try to fit in at some point. And I was miserable. And then in my adult life, kind of came across some other people from my school and they were like, God, you were like the only one who was really just themselves and seemed so confident. And I was like, that is the weirdest perception, but okay, cool.
I think I mean, I am aware of a similar thing with like the one kid who we sort of all suspected was gay when I was growing up that looking back, I was like, man, you were so brave. And I'm sure he was just like, everyone was mean to me. I had no choice but to be the way that I was.
Yeah. 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 I think that's right. I mean, it is that thing where everyone in school feels like there's a very clear linear food chain, but they're all on different pages about what right. that is.
When your mother died, was it something that happened abruptly or was it something you'd sort of knew was coming or?
No. So my mother was diagnosed with cancer before I was born.
Oh, wow.
And so she was in and out of treatment my entire life. So it was a thing that was so normalized that I really thought nothing of the fact that my mom was bald every couple years. Like it just was part of what I'd always known. So when she went into the hospital for that last time, toward the end, I saw her much sicker than I'd ever seen her. But her entering the hospital for that last time didn't feel foreboding. Because she always recovered.
So the hospital was just like a normal place for your mom to go.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, you know, I remember like I spent a summer with my godparents because my mom had to go to Nebraska to get a bone marrow transplant. There was just like stuff like that all the time when I was growing up, you know, like these long periods of her figuring out whether she wanted to do wigs or scarves and, you know, and that was just, it was all very normalized in my life. And so and I think my parents just kind of probably framed it really well for me. Like they made it so it wasn't a scary thing for me as a kid that was happening. And so, but as a result, it felt very unexpected. Like even though she was sick for so long, I did feel very blindsided by her death.
Did you know that she was going to die at some point before she died? Or was it just like, oh my gosh, she's dead now?
So get this, my dad, I came home from school one day and she'd been in the hospital for a while. And it's like, I look back at this, right? It's also weird to look at these things when you're a kid and then like look at them in retrospect because I'm like, oh yeah, I remember what she looked like. As an adult, she was very clearly dying, but I did not have a point of reference for that right. as a child, you know? It was like, so I didn't know, even though I think it was obvious, it would have been obvious, but so I remember coming home from school and my dad sat me down on the couch and he was just bawling. I mean, that was the other, right? Like that was such a hard thing was that my dad was so emotional that it was like he was in no place to like support a child through this because I found myself comforting him a lot. You know, it was like a lot of the time he had quicker access to tears. And so I was sort of there-thering him. But so he told me that my mom might die. And this was the day she died.
Like before she died or after she had died?
He told me before she died that she was going to die. But he did not tell me. Then she died at some point that day or night. And then he sent me to school the next day anyway and didn't tell me until I got home from school that next day that she was dead. So he couldn't even like bring himself to, he just didn't know what to do. And so there was a lot of resentment when I found that out, right? Obviously that like I had like gone about my day. I mean, not normally because I was in tears. I mean, I remember just sobbing in class because I'd just been told she was going to die the night before, but she was actually already dead. And that's like a weird thing to reflect on, yeah. You know. My English teacher went to church with her, and I remember my English teacher pulling me into the hallway and like just sort of holding me while I sobbed. And now I wonder, I'm like, did she know she was already dead? You know, I just don't know. And I was very angry at my father for a long time. Now I can understand it more.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think I understand it, but I understand why you would be super upset. Even with the empathy, it's still like, when something like that, like the first real big tragedy in your life happens, I think it's also, it's very destabilizing. It's like reality is not real anymore. And so now it's like, oh, wait, I can't even trust this guy. Like, he's not going to tell me the truth about this, about how the world is. And I already know that I was wrong about how the world is because my mother died. That seems very difficult.
Yeah. And there was just like, it was such a whirlwind. My dad was obviously, as I said, just sort of constantly in the throes of this very intense present mourning. And my grandparents were staying with us at the time because they were kind of like helping take care of things at home while that was happening. And I remember the moment my dad told me that she was dead, my grandparents like had been waiting outside the room and like swooped in and were like hugging me. And I remember, you know, which I know what the intention was there, but I remember so vividly how smothered I felt and that I felt like I had absolutely no room to have an emotion. Kids used to, I mean, kids would, God, kids are so fucking mean. Kids used to like make fun of me and talk about me because I didn't cry at my mom's funeral. Oh. And it was like a thing where that, you know what I mean? Like, and I was just, you know, whatever. I was a kid and I was in shock and I didn't, whatever. Who knows? Who knows? I don't need an excuse for that. But it was like, I heard about it for a long time after, kids talking about what a weirdo I was for not crying at my mom's funeral. But there were also, I mean, I also dealt with kids spreading rumors that my mom like died somehow because I was gay, like of shame. Like it was like literally, I mean, kids are terrible.
I mean, that's excruciating.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that your dad was so overwrought that you found yourself in a lot of situations trying to take care of him. Regardless of whether your relationship was strained, that shows a lot of love on the part of a child to like step in and do that. I mean, I would imagine he was trying in whatever way to take care of you. It sounds like in that grandparent plan, like they had a phone call and a big conversation about, you know, we're going to do this and then we're going to break the news. And then we are not going to allow for any space for there to be a total emotional breakdown, swoop in. You know, like they were trying, they had a plan, whether it was good or not.
Yeah, you know, and my that was sort of how my larger family tended to deal with things in general, right? Like I was actually outed by my, like I never got the opportunity to come out to my family because my dad was basically had like a, I know you're gay and it's okay conversation, which is nice, but it also doesn't allow you to come out. And then I started getting letters from my grandparents about how they knew a gay guy in college and it was okay, you know, and I was like, what? I didn't come out to any of you. So that was kind of like the vibe in my family, right? Was like to like smother the situation. Which the intentions were good. But yes, one thing my dad was great at was he was not in a position to really parent me a lot, but he knew that about himself and he outsourced a lot, which I think was the best possible thing he could do. You know, for a while we had like a, we called her a housekeeper, but she really wasn't. She was like, we had an extra room and this woman kind of came and lived with us. And she was again, like somebody who like went to my mom's church or something. And she was just like there to be like an adult who wasn't a mess, you know, so that there was someone there when I came home. And, you know, so my dad really just kind of stayed in his whirlpool of sadness. And I, and there was just like another adult there, you know, and at the time it like all felt weird. And but, you know, I think it was like a really smart move for him to know that he couldn't do that. And then eventually he actually sent me to boarding school, which I also think was, I mean, that I look back at as like a lifesaver. I think he was like, I don't know what to do with you and this, your environment, like these kids don't know what to do with you. So he sent me off to a school for the arts where I like met other gay kids for the first time. And it was like,
where was that school?
It was called Walnut Hill. It's in Natick, Massachusetts. Okay. And yeah, it was really, that was like an amazing flip. I went from, I mean, when I look back at those years before that, like kind of between the ages of like 12 and 16, I'm like, I don't think I ever was happy. Like I just never had a break from sadness those years, you know? And I remember that really changing and really being like, oh my God, I'm starting to be valued for the things that I've been looked down upon for, you know, like I'm a really good artist. And instead of being a freak, that makes me like popular. Kids don't care that I'm queer. And in fact, my queerness seems to be almost like a social boost in this situation. It was whiplash, but it was amazing.
Yeah, that's like the beautiful best case scenario of getting a chance to start over, that you can like establish yourself as somebody cool.
Yeah, you know, and it really like came from my dad just sort of giving in to the idea that he was helpless and needed to kind of send me somewhere else to have a different experience. And I'm really grateful for that.
I mean, I think that's a great thing for an adult to know, is their own limitations, and also like a really beautiful and generous way of you framing that decision. Like, it shows love, like both of those things. I think that's really wonderful. Did you have any other ways of dealing, like processing your mother's death? Did you, you went to therapy, right?
Straight to therapy and haven't come out
since.
Is that
part of like the grandparent swoop? Like, they come in, they hug, they drive you directly to a therapist.
Yeah, you know, I can't, I mean, I think I don't remember exactly how soon I was plunked into therapy or exactly how it happened, but I think, you know, I think that was my dad's work. And so I would see this therapist weekly, and, you know, I remember that being a great experience. It was an opportunity for me to just, I had so much sadness and I just didn't have anywhere to put it. There was nobody who would listen. And so even just that, just having like a contained space for an hour where somebody just listened to how sad I was, you know, and that was really helpful. And I'm a huge advocate of therapy. I have been in therapy for most of my life since, like on and off a few times, but you know, it's helped me so
much.
Not
with the same therapist the whole time.
Oh dear God, no. No, I also think it's so important to know when, as somebody who's been with a lot of therapists and has been in therapy for a lot of years, I think it's one thing that's really valuable is to know when your work with one therapist's style or approach is done and it's time to find somebody who challenges you. And that's been really useful in my life.
Can you talk
well.
About that more a little bit? Because I, as someone who's also been in therapy and out of therapy, a thing that I have found sometimes is like, I would just be going to a therapist and be like, I don't have anything for her. Like, I'm just too well adjusted this week to like think of anything. And I think that was because sort of the work that we were doing together had really been successful. You know what I mean? In a lot of ways it really helped me. And I was like, I don't know how else to continue doing this particular kind of work with you, but could you talk more about that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I just think there's always something that's next. You know, I think that there's, as depressing as this is, there's like never, you're never going to start peeling away layers of things that could be better, you know? And so, and it is, you know, I've had therapists who, you know, maybe I had to work through some of my sense of like needing that maternal figure. So I've had therapists that almost played a maternal figure in my life to sort of like help me build some of that stuff up. And then I've hit points where I'm like, oh, this is like in no way useful. And I've had therapists who I truly wasn't even sure if they liked me. And those I actually think were some of my best therapists, right? Because there was like this, and that's been a real cycle, is those types of connections that you can make, right? Because sometimes you're finding somebody that's maybe a substitute for a mother or father figure, and you're using that to work through your feelings about that person. But other times you need somebody who's like an objective observer who's like, no, you need to break these cycles. You're like, you know, get over yourself and stop whining. And I've had both of those types of therapists. But yeah, you know, I mean, I've been in phases of my life where I really needed to work through that sense of grief more. I've been in phases of my life where I really needed to get more comfortable and confident in myself as a queer person or also as an artist. And of course, you know, a lot of these things are linked. Like, I've had to work on like attachment stuff that of course is like deeply grief based, but also influenced by other stuff. I don't know. You know, it's just I recently sort of closed a chapter with a therapist where I was like, wow, we've really like done our work here. And she was like, yeah, we have. And I'm looking for a next therapist, but I'm still kind of figuring out what that is that I need next, because I do think it's going to be a very different direction.
The thing I was always worried about with restarting therapy with someone new was like, oh my, it's going to take so long to get up to the chapter in the book that I'm like, I'm always like, okay, here's my problem now, but let me explain to you where this problem comes from. And then we're going to have to book like 65 sessions back to back to get you from the beginning to where the problem is now.
I find the most exhausting part just the fucking speed dating of finding a new therapist is just so many first dates with so many therapists to find the one that seems like the next right fit. And then you might date for a couple more months and find that it's not right. You know, it really does feel like a dating cycle. But I also, you know, it's interesting that you just said that, because one thing in terms of different therapist styles that I found, some of them really want to know everything about my past and my journey and how I got here. And others are like, that really doesn't matter. What matters is how you're relating to things now and how you're making connections now. And yes, that's rooted in all that stuff, but we don't need to know that to do the work. And I've had therapists with both approaches, and I found both to be useful at different times.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I wanted to ask you about medication also.
Oh, I love it. Crazy about it.
And have you been on it since your mother died?
No. So I was prescribed Prozac around that age, like probably, you know, 13, 14, when, you know, that was like the hot thing to do. I am not on that drug anymore. I haven't been for some time, but truly, some of those types of antidepressants are a terrible thing to put a child on during puberty. And part of the reason is there's all these sexual side effects that as a child you cannot talk about. And you also are like, I'm developing sexually and what the hell is going on?
I don't even know what those are. Like, what, if I may ask, are
they
those
do
effects?
Not talk to kids about this. Like, depressed sex drive. I mean, basically, you, like, some people, just your sex drive completely is depleted. And so as a kid who was going through puberty and everybody around me was sex crazed and I had like zero impulse toward sex, even though I knew I was very queer and like attracted and like interested in boys, it was so confusing. And I thought something was deeply wrong with me. And it took years for somebody to say, oh, no, that's the medication. I mean, that was a time, I think, that a lot of kids were getting prescribed Prozac and that nobody was like, thought a kid was grown up enough to know about what else it might do to them, you know? So anyway, that was like, in some ways, Prozac caused some more trauma for me. So I got off that, you know, a few years later and I was like, this is not for me. And then I resisted medication for many, many years. I was like, I don't want to do it. And I then like dabbled a bit, like, you know, I had therapists who were like, I really think that we can find something else that might work for you. And I tried a lot of those different serotonin reuptake inhibitor situations, mm-hmm. you know, and found that none of them really helped. And they all kind of only made me sadder sometimes.
Okay, not good.
Or feel like cloudier or weirder. And so, and I tried a lot of combinations of those in like my early 20s. And then I was like, okay, this isn't for me. I'm not doing it. And then in my mid 30s, I finally had somebody say, I don't think what you have is depression. I think you have bipolar. And I got on a mood stabilizer. I went on medication for bipolar and everything changed. And that was the secret. You know, since I have learned that those other types of medication do exacerbate the
particular problem you had.
Yeah, exactly. So they actually do make it worse, but I was just being constantly misdiagnosed. And so it was for a long time, I was just like, oh my God, I never want to be on medication. It's such a terrible thing. And then once I found the right one, I was like, oh my God, I'm sad this took so long, but I'm really happy I got it because, man, it made a huge difference.
Yeah, I've heard that from other people who have really benefited from medication. That story almost verbatim of like the first thing I was on, whatever it was, turned out not to be the right thing for me and made me feel tons worse. Okay, we're getting so close to the end of our time, and I want to talk for sure about drag and how does your performance and like your art help you process grief to this day? Are there ways in which that interacts with your experience with grief?
100%. Yeah, I mean, you know, I just to address it, you know, people sort of ask me about when I started doing drag, and I definitely was always, you know, when I was very young, I was always, you know, when we would play make-believe, like my cousins and I was always the female characters. I was also always directing. I was like assigning characters and like making us make up plays for our parents and stuff. But all that is to say that for me, drag falls somewhere in between an artistic practice and identity, and it's very much intertwined with who I am. So the art that I make utilizes drag, but I would say that drag itself is very much just a part of who I am, and it's what I use to do this art. But the art I make is influenced by my life experiences. And so grief is played into my work a lot. And my most recent solo show, actually, that I was touring last year, is called Ready to Be Committed. And it's kind of on the surface, it's about marriage. And it's about, you know, my shows are very like campy and over the top and colorful and ridiculous. But one of the things that I really love about comedy and camp specifically is the way that you can kind of lead people to these more, to opening up to kind of more complicated ideas that are harder. And so on the surface, this show is about my character deciding she's going to get married and then realizing that she has to find a spouse in order to do that. And then she's like sort of going on this journey around that. And I play a lot of different characters within the show. But what the show is actually about that it sort of arrives at is what I have discovered about my own fears around commitment and how informed they are about watching my dad lose my mom at a young age. And that from a very early age, especially given the sort of romances I saw between my parents, the idea of, you know, becoming romantically linked with somebody was intrinsically tragic. There was like, you know, it was, this is how the best case scenario of romance where you don't fall out of love is that you watch somebody die. And that's what that show's about. And it's all through, you know, puppetry and dick jokes, but it's, you know, but I'm still making work about that stuff because I'm still discovering the echoes of what this plays in my life, you know, and my way of, I think, processing a lot of my more complicated thoughts is to make art about them that is not so much about my own experience, because it's written through a lot of highly stylized fiction. Like, it's not personal about my life, but it's about the topics. And it's always, I always find myself, whether on purpose or not, writing from a place of comforting. So it's always kind of about how do we arrive by the end of this show at some sort of sense of catharsis with this idea or a sense of hope within this idea, but while not backing away from the complexity or sadness of the idea. So that show was about that. You know, I do an annual holiday show with Jinx Monsoon every year that I produce and direct and we co-write. And it's that, but the sort of impetus for that was creating something about a time of year that is about, you know, we're inundated with this imagery of homecoming and family togetherness and stuff like that. And as queer people, a lot of us have difficult relationships to that. But also, like, I have not had a sense of home since I lost my mom, you know? And so creating these holiday shows where I had a place to go on Christmas and it was on stage, but ostensibly the show is creating a space for a community to come and have a place to go on Christmas. And so, but it's about that. It's about that sense of loss and building chosen family. And and so I do think that all of my work has this you know, there's this thread throughout it.
That's fascinating. I wonder, you talk about, and I don't want to mischaracterize what you're saying, but you talk about drag sort of like being like a tool that you use to express the views that you hold personally and to talk about your life experience and to comfort people. Do you find that there are ways in which drag is especially good at helping you do that? And conversely, ways that it is limiting?
Well, you know, there's so many styles of drag that it's almost difficult to, you know, talk about it in a sweeping way, because a lot of people have their preconceived notions of what drag is. And that's because there's so many different kinds of drag to have witnessed, right? But the drag that I fell in love with at a very young age is, you know, the work of some, you know, there's been so many phenomenal queens that sort of came before me and came before the big drag boom that we're in now. But Charles Bush, who's a playwright and an actor who did off-Broadway work. Varla Jean Merman, who's a cabaret artist, a singer and a storyteller. Coco Peru, who people are very aware of right now, but her live work is really where she's just incredible, because she is a monologuist and she really goes into emotional work within her comedy. And so what I loved about all of that stuff was that it is drag, like, pulls you in this way that, you know, comedy is part of it, right? Comedy pulls us in and it allows us to drop some of our walls in order to receive some other information. But so does spectacle, right? Like, you throw bright colors and sparkles on something and people are lured in a way where it feels fanciful, it feels fun, it feels light, it feels like escapism. And this sort of larger than life characters, right? These characters that live on the same plane as Pee-wee Herman or Elvira, right? These characters who are so out of the realm of the reality we know, but they're so grounded that we believe it. You know, they really, they understand their internal logic, so we will go on that ride. And I think that all of this artifice that goes along with this kind of storytelling and drag, artifice is a great way to reach truth, because people don't really like delving straight into truth. They don't really. I'm a very sentimental person. I'm a person who really wants to be earnest in my work, but people don't like that. It scares them away. And I also love all of these other aspects of what I do, but it allows me to bring people on this path. And I really think there's something about this camp sensibility. There's something about the idea that it's considered lowbrow, right? Like, there's a lot of, like, that's sort of this vaudevillian sensibility, drag, all these things are continued, like, they're considered low art. And I think so people don't feel like they're gonna, they don't have to be afraid. It's not Ivory Tower. They don't have to, like, be able to sit through a slow film with subtitles, right? But you,
right.
But you give them just so much candy, and then you've got those, like, you know, vegetables baked into the French fries or whatever, that, you know, it's a really, it's, I find that I can write work through this, that people, almost every show that I've written in the last, like, 8 years has, you know, I love that people are like, oh my God, it's so funny, I had such a good time. But what I love even more is how many people say to me, thank you, you really spoke to something for me. You really, like, made me access something, or you made me think about something differently. You know, I see a lot of reviewers or people, like, posting things online that really talk about, like, whoa, this really made me change the perspective on something I've been thinking about. And after this show, Ready to Be Committed, that was all about sort of relationships and the fear of loss, and when I wrote that, I was very much like, this needs to resonate with people who are happy in their relationship, who are unhappy in their relationship, who are single and happy or single and unhappy, and to people who have lost their partners. And this has to speak to everyone, you know. And so, and the feedback I got in terms of that was amazing. And then most of the feedback I get is, oh my God, I never laughed so hard. That was so fun. Right. Because it's like, because that's what drag can do. It can, like, you can put this candy coating over everything, and then people can take what they want. You know, they can just take the fun, light stuff, or they can go on the ride with you, because you're giving them two levels at once. And so that's what I love about
that's brilliant.
What I do.
A little bit of a digression from this maybe is that you talked about the show's called Ready to Be Committed. You talked about how your sort of model for, like, the best case scenario in a committed relationship where you don't fall out of love, it has an incredibly tragic outcome, has the grief of your mother's loss, I assume, had an impact one way or another on your own personal romantic life?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's just that. And it's, you know, I have been with my partner Gus for 8 years now. But that was, right, like this show came out of some things I discovered within this relationship about myself, and that, you know, and that discovery of that there was this part of me that was unwilling to fully let myself go into a relationship because of having seen the way that that decimated my father. I found this about myself. I found that I was getting stuck in it and I didn't know what to do. So I wrote a drag show about it.
I mean, and when you go to perform something like that, something so personal, how long do you have to do it before it's not scary to you? I mean, I do like work about grief and talk about it in comedy. And the first few times I'm always like, this could go so bad.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, I mean, that's also one of the great things about the medium I work in is that nobody has to know how personal it is because my drag character right. is not me. And she is this sort of like cartoony larger than life. Like she doesn't, you know, like she's a cartoon character and she goes on these journeys with other characters and she doesn't have to have the same journey as me. And if anything, you know, I didn't go to school for theater. I went to school for fine arts. And one of the best things that was instilled in me there was nobody cares about your experience and they don't want to read your diary entry. What they want is for you to distill the set of feelings or thoughts that you're having and give it to them in the version that resonates with them and elicits those feelings and thoughts in them. And that was such a valuable thing to learn because I don't like that. That's what I do within these stories is I find these ways to write. Like, for instance, fear of dying alone has not been something that I've given a lot of thought to, but it is a main central thought within that show is that this character's fear is of dying alone on one level. And then later she gets to this idea of the fear of commitment and that there are potentially no happy endings. And right. Like either way, you're taking a risk. You could wind up alone and miserable either way. And so you just have to go for the journey because you can't make one of those things happen. You just have to be present where you are and you have to allow yourself to enjoy attachment while you have the opportunity to. And you have to let go in order to fully be present with that. But that, you know, those are all broad ideas that I wanted to find ways that everyone could hook into because I knew that everyone's experience would not be my experience and everyone's background would not be my background. So because of all that and because of that artifice and because of how fun and light she is, and she always sort of speaks in malapropisms and puns that she's largely unaware of, that it's this shell, it's protective, it's armor, you know? So I don't have to feel as vulnerable as I would if I were going out there playing myself.
Yeah. I mean, this is obviously a like inane observation, but as someone who has seen some drag performance, you might not walk into something like that prepared for profundity on the scale that you're describing. Like think of it as like a time when an incredibly talented person fucks around for a little bit. That's my viewpoint. When I go into a drag show, I'm like, I'm ready for someone to fucking blow the doors off this place, just fucking around and being talented. So I can imagine, I haven't seen the show, but I can imagine what it would like, what a gut punch it would be, specifically for someone like me, who's like, you know, turning everything into some lesson about grief, to go to a show and have an immensely talented performer be like, oh, and also I'm talking about this stuff.
Yeah, no, blindsiding audiences is one of my absolute like pleasures in life. You know, it's like, it's so right. I mean, that it really is. It's like, drag and that sort of spectacle is such a perfect diversion to distract people from what it is that you're actually getting at, you know? And then by the time it's arrived, they weren't ready for it, but they're so open to it because making people laugh and bring like it lets people's guard down. And so then they'll go somewhere really emotional or really profound with you in that way. And I love that so much. And that's also sort of what I'm talking about with like the breadth of what drag can be. It's so hard to, right? It's like, there is a lot of drag that is really masterful, high energy dance and lip sync in a 5-minute format, right? And that's awesome. And it is one style of drag. And it's also like, you know, I write 70 to 90 minute shows about
right.
serious topics told through ridiculous means.
And you also performed the show in Torrington, correct?
Mm. Oh my God, yes.
So that like, taking a show that has these themes back to, like, you know, where your mother used to live? And
when we routed this tour and we got that offer for Torrington, I was like, we can't do this. We can't. And then I sort of was thinking through it and I was like, well, you know, it might be an interesting cathartic experience. Let's go ahead and book it. And then immediately regretted it and was absolutely horrified and terrified the entire way leading up to that particular performance, because I did have such a unpleasant experience there with my childhood. I don't particularly enjoy going home. I tend to make my father meet me elsewhere. You know, I really, and you know, I would do these, you know, you have to do all this publicity for stuff and people, you know, these local rags would be like, tell us about the hometown connection, and be like, you don't want to hear about it. You know, I was sort of lying through my teeth about like, oh, it's going to be so wonderful to go home. But it was amazing. I did not anticipate the fact that, I mean, I guess I did at some point because I agreed to do it, but it was so cathartic and it was so crazy. And it was not only, there were all these people from my past that showed up, and it was really amazing to be like, whoa, I felt so weak and helpless when I was here. And now I am standing in front of you on this huge stage that I used to see musicals on in like the Nutcracker when I was a child. And you are all watching me run this room in a way that I've learned to do, that I, you know, it also gave me perspective on like, man, I got good at my job, you know? So it was like, so that was all amazing. And then there was this other half to it where, you know, like I said, when I grew up there, I was the only queer kid that was out, and there were all these young queer people in the audience. And, you know, I do these meet and greets after, and there were people who were talking to me who were just like, it's so hard to be, and there were like young kids who wanted to be drag queens. They were like, it's so hard to drag here. It's so hard to be queer here. And when I heard that you were from here, it made such a huge difference. And I felt so much more confident and so much more like I could go out there and do this, and that there was a future for me. And it means so much that you came back. And it was, I did not expect all that. I did not expect it to be just such an overwhelming positive experience.
That's incredible. Yeah, to be in that place where you were an outcast at the bottom of the social ladder and to be like the queen of Torrington is kind of crazy.
It was kind of crazy.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, it was like, you know, it wasn't my most like high profile gig, but it was definitely one of the most personally rewarding.
I wanted to ask you about how, are there things that you feel like you've learned from grief, like that your relationship to your mother's passing has taught you?
Yeah. And I know that I sound confused, because I know that I felt like that was different things over the course of my life, right? Like, I know that there have been different times in my life where I've been like, oh, this is how this served me. This is what I learned from that. This is, you know, what I took away from that. But overall, I'd say that the amount of resilience that I gained from it is like a big one. If you can make it through a loss that feels that all-encompassing and years of what feels like things will never be okay, and come out on the other end and be like, oh wow, everything's okay, there's very little after that that you don't know you can recover from, you know?
Yeah. I mean, sort of surprisingly, that's not an answer that someone's given to that question before, but it seems so like obviously true. That is, yeah. It's something that teaches you that you have the ability to survive things.
Yeah. And that really, you know, those times of your life where your brain and heart are telling you that there is no other side and there is, you know, you are absolutely done for, that your brain and your heart are not always correct about that.
And do you think of your mother as someplace now? Do you ever like address her, or do you have beliefs that put her somewhere?
Yeah, you know, I don't, I do not have any sort of formal spiritual idea of an afterlife, but I also don't not, you know, I feel very like open to that, like, who am I to decide whether or not that could be true or not, you know? And I also, and this hooks in a little bit to something that we were touching on earlier in terms of, right, like, I've had people be like, okay, so your bipolar started when your mom died? Like, what does that, you know, like, so how do you know that wasn't just grief and it's been, you know, blah, blah, blah. And my answer is, who cares? You know, yeah. Like, I found a path and some tools that made me feel like I could move through that. And I do not care if they are placebos or if they're true, you know, it just doesn't matter. And I feel similarly about spirituality. There have been, and that connection to a, you know, a deceased loved one. I have been through periods of time where I do talk to her. I have, you know, gone to see various spiritual professionals and had experiences where they, you know, have either connected me or have said they were connecting me with my mother. And I've just decided pretty early on in my life that I don't care to dissect that if it makes me feel closer to her and if it makes me feel more at peace. And it can be that person leading me through something that they see me as needing emotionally, or it could be a real connection. And it is not important to me which thing it is. But so I have had that, and I have had that opportunity to connect with either her or the idea of her in that way. And I find that very valuable.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that sort of sense of, it doesn't really have to be true. It has to be true in some way to me. Right. And that's kind of enough.
Which, as soon as you say it out loud, really connects to how I think about my performance stuff too, right? Like, it's artifice, and it doesn't have to be true to get at a truth.
Are there ways in which, one of the things you mentioned as sort of something you took as normal when you were little was that your mom was deciding between like wearing wigs and scarves and that kind of thing. Yeah. There is and maybe this is like a remedial question, but there is a part of me that sees, like, you know, does your mother wearing wigs, do you think that has any connection to
Well, ultimately, she decided not to, and she just wore really fabulous scarves. But no, I mean, I don't think that, you know, it's, I think there's validity to that question. And I think that when I was young and those cruel, awful kids saying cruel, awful things, there was also, right, the reverse narrative of what I said, which is that, like, oh, Ben's mom dying made him gay, right? And
sure. So
there have been, when I went on Drag Race, I talked about my mother's death, and there were like trolls on the internet who decided to connect those ideas, right? And that's always through sort of a negative light, right? Which is not my impression of your question at all, right? Like, because, yeah, it makes sense that there could possibly be connections drawn between those things. But in the same vein as I don't care to explore certain things, it's like there's an idea where people, I think some people would want to invalidate one by connecting it to the other. And that is just something that is, I'm like, I don't care to open that can of worms. It's similar to the, right, the born this way idea, where I'm like, I don't care whether I'm born this way. That has no impact on whether you need to respect me or not. Right. I think it's a distraction, those conversations. So anyway, I just haven't found that it serves me, is all.
That's a beautiful, wise answer to that question. Is there anything else on the subject of grief that you wish I had asked you about, or that you want to say? There doesn't have to be.
I don't think so. I think we really like griefed it up pretty hard.
We really griefed it up. Okay, well then, in that case, this has been A Good Cry with Ben de la Creme. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter, and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by V. Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.